Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stassi Olkowski.
And today is Monday, November 20th. Our theme today is Grateful for the Now. And we have some unusual, different stories for you today. But Stash, tell us about your weekend.
Oh.
Tell us about whatever you want to tell us about.
Okay. Well, it was a lovely, gentle weekend this weekend, which is nice. I did get an invitation to a Thanksgiving dinner from one of my nieces. However, we won't be going because we generally don't do Thanksgiving. In fact, the last time we did a Thanksgiving dinner was at Mark's house, Mark Brew. And that was when we first moved to the Sharpsburg area. But we had a horrible event on Thanksgiving and decided years ago that we will not travel at Thanksgiving. We will not go any places at Thanksgiving unless it's really close. And we'll have Thanksgiving dinner at home. I know my wife will fix a lovely dinner and it'll be scrumptious and I will really enjoy it, and we'll watch football and the Macy's parade.
That's great.
All right. Last week, I saw the most amazing performance by a storyteller that I've seen in many years. I would rank it as one of the top three storytelling performances I ever saw in my whole life. It was done by Bill Harley. He did There is a New Modern Version of the Iliad, and was written by a couple of people in the New York area, and it is licensed. You can get a copy of the play. It's a one-person play, about an hour and a half to an hour and 45 minutes, with no intermission, and a one-person play. It was just marvelous. It was absolutely the best, one of the best shows I've ever seen in my whole life of any kind of stage performance. But it was done by Bill Harley, who is a Grammy Award winner and who is also a great storyteller. And normally when he performs, and I've heard him a number of times, he's very funny. He does a lot of humor, he does a lot of stuff about teenage boys and teenagers in general. And they're you know, foibles and things, and sings and stuff, and you know, he's a real crowd pleaser, and to have him completely to do something so completely different than most of his performance style was wonderful, because you know the audience was so touched, and we had a great 25 minutes afterwards of give and take. And I was so struck by it that even though one of the things afterwards I talked to Bill Harley about, and I said to him, you know, as at my age, I don't remember things very well, but if I were 30 years younger, I would get a copy of that script and I would begin studying it the day I got the copy so I could try to perform it. And he said, well, it's a shame you can't do it now because you're a perfect age. He said the performer is supposed to be an older person, and you know, and he was very nice. He said, "I'm sure you would do a good job," and so I did that very night. Sent right to New York,
wow.
And gave my credit card number and asked for it to be sent first class mail for the script. So for the play copy. So, and I am going to study it. I may never get to do anything with it, but I am going to study it because it was so beautiful. And even if I wind up doing it for myself in my basement or something, I want to look at it at least and try, you know, some of it.
You'll do it at Stories in the Round.
You think you are you bold enough to take a chance on me for that?
Of course.
Okay. We'll see.
We'll see what happens. That's right.
I don't know. Have you ever had cue cards and Stories in the Round?
Oh, sure. Well, we did. We did our plays with cue cards.
I know. The last thing I'm going to say before we go on with the real storytelling is I think we actually got away with having notes, and the way we did it with the Diaries of Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. with those wooden note pads and our wooden pencils and stuff. I'm not so sure that the audience didn't know that we were reading some of that.
Oh, of course they knew it.
Do you think so?
Oh yeah, for sure. Didn't bother them.
Yeah,
it was fine.
No, it didn't. And I have done that without a book in my hand.
Right.
You know, but of course that was years ago when my mind was still sharp and fresh.
All right. I'm going to say a few words about Stories in the Round because Adam Booth is our featured teller.
I know.
November 27th.
Looking Monday, forward to it.
At 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church, 13245 Searfoss Pike. And you can get tickets by calling me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638 or emailing me at fenitsky@hotmail.com.
So, you know, we'll be there.
Yes, I do have your email. You emailed
I've me. Only ever missed Stories in a Round once.
So this session by Bill Harley was the last session of Speak, right?
Yes.
But
yes.
People can still get tickets for the new season.
Yes, and absolutely. And speakstoryseries.com. And I guarantee that next season is going to be dynamite. I haven't seen the list, but Adam said it's going to be marvelous. And Adam said, when I saw him last week, I said, when are you going to put out the list? I'm anxious to see this. He said, you will be really happy because you will see some of the best people we've ever had here. So great. That's great. You know, and do you know what Adam's telling on Monday?
No, he has not told us. All he says is that it's new material and it's Appalachian Tales.
Oh, good. Okay, great. Well, that'll be super duper, you know.
Yeah. Okay,
and
well, I'm gonna...
Thanks to Andy.
Yes, indeed. Andy Offord Irwin for opening the show, our good friend.
With Terry here.
Much, much admired. Yes. Singer-songwriter and storyteller. Terry here opened the show, and we are very grateful for that.
Okay. I know you have a long story, and I'm waiting to hear it.
It is. Okay. So I'm telling a story from A.S. Byatt, who is a writer who's left us now. She's deceased, but she wrote amazing fairy tales, and this is one of those folk tales that she put together. It's called The Dragon's Breath. And I've adapted it a little bit because it's much longer than this if I did the whole thing, but we're gonna do a shortened version of it. And I wanna thank A.S. Byatt and her estate for this great opportunity. Once upon a time, in a village, in a valley, in the midst of a high mountains, lived a family, two brothers, Harry and Jack, and a sister called Eva. The village was on the lower slope of a mountain, while below in the deep bowl of the valley was a lake, clear as crystal on its shores, black as ink in its unplumbed center. Thick pine forests grew in the shadow of the mountain ridges, but the village stood amongst flowery meadows, orchards, cornfields, not always bountiful, but sufficient to the needs of the villagers. The peaks of the mountains were inaccessible, covered with blue ice and glittering snowfields. The sides of the mountains were scored with long descending channels, like the furrows of some monstrous plow. In some countries, circular impressions around certain hills are ascribed to the coiling grip of ancient dragons. But in this village, in this place, the tale was that in some primeval time, the channels were cut by the descent of giant worms from the mountain peaks. Sometimes sitting by a warm fire on a bitterly cold night, parents frightened their children, pleasurably enough, with tales of the flaming descent of dragons of old. Harry, Jack, and Eva were not afraid of dragons, but they were, in their different ways, afraid of boredom. For life in that village repeated itself. People were born, became lovers, became parents and grandparents, and died. They were somewhat inbred, of course. The outside world was far away, hard to reach, and few traders came and went, irregularly and only in summer. The villagers offered in trade only a traditional kind of rug from hand looms with a limited range of vegetable colors, beet or blood red, a dark blue, sandy yellow, and charcoal black. The few traditional designs were a branching tree with fruit like pomegranates, roosting pheasant-like birds, and an abstract geometrical design. The rugs were generally made by the women. Harry was a swineherd with a particular friend amongst the pigs, a young boar called Boris, who made cunning escapes and dug up unexpected truffles. But Boris's playfulness was not enough to mitigate Harry's prevailing boredom and dreams of great cities beyond the mountains, streaming with urgent people.
Be careful.
All
love you.
Different, all busy. Jack dug in the fields, sowed and harvested. He liked to see the corn come up, green spikes from the black earth, and he knew where to find a few greens and wild honey. But these treats did little to mitigate his boredom. He dreamed of ornamental gardens inside high walls round huge palaces, subtle scents, spices, fiery spirits unknown in the valley. He dreamed wild dances, bodies flung about to music on instruments he knew only by name, zither, bongo, grand piano. Eva made the rugs. She could have woven in her sleep, she thought, sometimes waking to find her mind buzzing with repeats and variations, twisting threads and shifting warp and weft. She dreamed of unknown colors, purple, vermilion, turquoise, and orange, colors of flowers and feathers. She dreamed of an older Eva, robed in crimson and silver. She dreamed of the sea, which she could not imagine, of salt water, and tasted her own impatient tears. She was not good at weaving, her tension too tight, her patterns bunched, but this was her task. She was a weaver. She wanted to be traveler, sailor, learned doctor, opera singer in front of flaring footlights and the roar of the crowd. Well, the first sign may have been hunters' reports of unusual snow slides in the high mountains. They heard strange rumblings up there above the snow line, which they discussed, as they discussed every strange and accustomed sound, repetitious commentary that made Jack and Harry grind their teeth with rage at the sameness of it all. After a time, it seemed clear that the rim of the mountains directly above the village, by day and by night, was flickering and dancing with a kind of fiery haze, smoky salmon pink, a burst here and there of crimson and gold. Rather beautiful, all agreed, as they watched from their doorsteps, ribbons of color flashing through the gray-blue smokiness of the air, then subsiding. Below this, the white of snow was giving way to the gaunt gray of wet rock and shimmer. Yes, they must have been afraid from the beginning. They could see large changes were taking place, that everything was on the move, earth and air and steam, new water. But fear was mixed with excited interest and even a certain pleasure in novelty, aesthetic pleasure, of which many were later ashamed. Hunting parties went out in the direction of the phenomenon and reported the hillside seemed to be on the move, boiling and burning. It was hard to see through thick clouds of ash and smoke and steam that hung over the movement. The mountains were not, as far as anyone knew, volcanic, but the lives of human beings are short alongside the history of rocks and water. After some time, they saw on the skyline lumps like the knuckles of a giant fist, six lumps where nothing had been before, lumps that might represent, at that distance, objects the size of small houses. Over the next week, the lumps advanced in smoke and spitting sparks, regularly, slowly, side by side, without hesitation, down the mountainside. Behind each lump trailed a long, unbending tube or earthwork, climbing over the crest of the mountain, over the rim of their world, pouring slowly on and down. Some brave villagers went out to prospect, but were forced back by clouds of scalding steam and showers of burning grit. Two friends, bold hunters both, went out and never returned. One day, a woman in her garden said, "It's almost as though it was not landslides, but creatures, great worms with fat heads creeping, great fat nodding bald heads with knobs and whelks and whorls on them, nasty hot wet eyes in great caverns in their muddy flesh, glinting blood red. 12 eyes, can you see? 12 hairy nostrils on blunt snouts of gray mud." After conversations and comparisons and pointings, they could all see them. Just as she said, six fat, lolling, loathsome heads trailing heavy bodies. They seemed to move with difficulty, even pain, but unrelenting and deadly slow, almost dreamlike. Nearer now, their great jaws could be seen, jaws wide as whales, armed with a scythe-like flinty edge, like a terrible beak with which they excavated and swallowed layers of the earth and everything on it. Fences, haystacks, fruit trees, two goats, a black and white cow, duck pond, and the life in it. They sucked and sighed with a low rustling noise, spat fine ash or dribbled it from terrible jaws. It settled on everything. The cloud of ash came before them, falling on every surface, on and inside houses, gardens, coated the windows, filmed the wells. It stank, the ash, unspeakably foul. At first, the people grumbled and dusted, then gave up dusting, for it was no use, and began to be afraid, all so slow that there was a period of unreal, half-titillating fright before real, sick, paralyzing fear took hold. That was when the creatures were close enough for men and women to see their eyes, which were rimmed with a gummy discharge like melting rubber, and their tongues of flame, nothing like the brave red banners of painted dragons in churches, nothing like flaming swords of archangels. They were molten, lolling, covered with a leathery, transparent skin, thick with crimson warts, taste buds glowing like coals, the size of cabbages, slavering with some sulfurous glue, stinking of despair and endless decay. Repulsive bodies, humped, slithered, crushed, slow, gray, and indiscriminate. Their faces, too big to be seen as faces, only identified in parts successively, but the stench was the worst, inducing fear, panic, and a fatalistic tremor of paralysis, like rabbits before stoats, mice before vipers. So the villagers left it very late to make a plan to evacuate their village, and in the end, left hurriedly, messily, running here and there in the stink and smoke, snatching up belongings, putting them down, snatching up others, seething like an ant's nest. They ran to the forest with sacks of corn and cooking pots, feather beds, sides of bacon, bewildered by the presence of the loathsome creatures. It was not clear exactly that the worms saw the human beings. The human beings were not on their scale, like the small creatures that inhabit our scalps or burrow in the salad leaves we eat are to us. We take no account. The villagers' life in the forest became monotonous, boring even, since boredom is possible for human beings in patches of tedium between exertion and terror. They were very cold, especially at night, hungry, stomachs constantly queasy with fear and with their ramshackle diet. They knew they were beyond the perimeter of the worm's breath, yet smelled its foul odor in their dreams, in the smoke from their campfires, in rotting leaves. Watchers posted to see the distant outline of the village, the advancing line of gross heads, bursts of sudden flame and spurts of dense smoke, the kindling of burning houses, watched the destruction of their world and felt a kind of ennui. You might ask, where were the warriors who would ride out to put an arrow or a bullet into those drooling eyes? They spoke of this round campfires, but no heroes sprang up. Perhaps this was wise. The worms invulnerable to the pinprick of human weapons? The elder said it was best to let things go by. Those huge bodies would be almost as bad dead in the village amidst. The old women said that old tales told that dragon's breath paralyzed the will, but asked for practical advice they had none to offer. You could want to kill yourself, Eva found out, sleeping on a tree root on the hard ground, which pressed into cold flesh and became an excruciating pain, boring in both senses. Harry and Jack finally went with other young men out in the direction of the village to see the nature and extent of the devastation. They found they were walking towards a wall of evil-smelling smoke and flame extending across acres of pasture and cornfield, behind which the great crag-like protuberances of the heads could be seen further apart now. Jack said that this fanning out of paths left little chance that anything in the village might be left standing. Harry replied that there were figures moving in the smoke, and then that they were the pigs running here and there, squealing. A pig shot out of the smoke, panting and squeaking, and Harry called out, "Boris!" and began to run after his pig, which snorted wildly and charged back into the darkness, followed by Harry. And Jack saw pig and human in sooty silhouette before he heard a monstrous sucking sound, an exhalation of hot vapors, thick, choking, fiery breath, which sent him staggering and fainting back. When he came to, his skin was thick with adhesive ash, and he could hear, it seemed, the liquids boiling and burning in the worm's belly. For a moment, he thought he would simply lie there in the path of that jaw, scooped up with the cornfield and the hedgerow. Then he found he had decided to roll away, little by little, rolling, crawling, scrambling. He put space between himself and the worm. He lay for hours, winded, sick under a thorn bush before picking himself painfully up, returning to the camp in the forest. He hoped that Harry too would return, but was not really surprised when he did not. So it dragged on for weeks, months, with the air full of ash and cinders, clothes and flesh permeated by that terrible smell, until little by little, the long, loathsome bodies dragged past, across the fields, the meadows, leaving behind those same furrows of rocky surface scooped clean of life. From a hilly point, they saw the creatures side by side cross the sandy shore of the lake, without changing pace, advance across the shallows, as though driven by mechanical necessity or some organic need, like the periodic return of toads to a watery world to breed. The great heads dipped to meet the lake surface, and where they met, it boiled and steamed and spat like a great cauldron. Then the heads went under the surface, which still boiled, puckered, bubbling as the slow lengths of the long bodies humped, slithered, day after day over the sand, down through the water to the depths, until finally only blunt, ugly butts could be seen under the shallows. Then one day, as uncertainly as their coming had been established, it was clear that their going was over, that the worms had plunged into, through, under the lake, leaving only the harsh marks of their body's weight and burning breath in the soil, the rock, the vegetable world crushed and withered. When the villagers returned to look on their village from a distance, the devastation seemed uniform. Houses, trees uprooted, earth scored, channeled, ashy, smoking. They wandered in the ruins, turning over bricks and boards. Some people finding lost treasures, trivia in the ashes, a coin, half a book. Some people who had vanished in the early chaos returned with singed eyebrows or seared faces. Others did not. Jack and Eva came back together and for a moment could not figure out in what direction to look for the ruins of their house. Coming around a heap of fallen rubble, they saw it there, untouched. One of the dragon troughs passed at a distance parallel to the garden fence, but the fence stood, and inside the fence, the garden, the veranda, the door, the windows were as they always had been, apart from the drifting ash. Jack lifted the stone under which the key was always kept, and there was the key where it had always been. And Jack and Eva entered the house. There were the tables, chairs, fireplace, bookcase, Eva's loom standing in the window at the back of the house where you looked out on the slopes and up at the peaks of the mountains. And there was a heavy thumping against the back door, which Jack opened. There was Boris, the pig, hanging his head a little and giving off an odor of roast pork, not a bristle on his charred rind, but with pleasure and recognition in his deep-set little eyes. And when they saw that the pig had by some miracle escaped the dragon breath and fiery tongues, they hoped that Harry too would return. They hoped for days, months, and against their reasonable judgment for years, but he did not. Eva dusted her rug, lightly filmed with ash, since it was at the back of the house and the windows were well made. She saw the colors, red, blue, yellow, black, as though she had never seen color before, with disturbed pleasure at their odd familiarity. Eva felt such amazement now about her own work, the persistence of wood and wool and bone shuttle, the unfinished pattern of the tree with its squatting pheasants and fat pomegranates. She felt inwardly moved, shaken by this form of her own past and the past of her mother and grandmother, by the traces of the moments of her own flowing competence and periods of bunching, tension, anxiety, fumbling. Jack felt delight and amazement, walking repeatedly across the house from the windows, opened on smoldering devastation to those from which he could see unchanging mountains. Both embraced Boris, feeling his wet snout and warm flanks. Such wonder, such amazement. The exact opposite of boredom. And many people know them only after fear and loss. Once known, wonder cannot be completely forgot, casting flashes and floods of paradisal light in odd places at odd times. The villagers rebuilt their village. The rescued things in the rescued house stood amongst new houses, in whose gardens new flowers and vegetables sprouted. The people began to tell tales about the coming of the worms down the mountain, and the tales too were the opposite of boredom. They made ash and bad breath, crushing and swallowing, interesting, exciting, almost beautiful. Some things they made into tales, and some things they did not speak. Jack told of Harry's impetuous bravery, rushing to the billowing smoke to save his pig. Nobody told the day-to-day misery of the slowly diminishing hope of his return. The resourcefulness and restoration of the pig were celebrated, but not his inevitable fate in these hard days. These tales, made from these people's wonder at their own survival, became charms against boredom for their children and grandchildren, riddling hints of the true relations between peace and beauty and terror. And there was the key, where it had always been.
Wow.
I love that story. Isn't that scary, scary, scary?
Yeah.
And stuff like that happening all over the world.
Yeah. I was like 23 minutes.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more.
Yep. I did time it. It was really long. Thank you for being so patient.
No problem. It was the only part of it that bothered me was when they opened the door and I forget the name.
Boris.
The pig.
Yeah.
And they could smell, the smell was of roasted pig.
Yeah.
But he wasn't really roasted.
Well,
right?
He'd been singed.
He'd been singed. And I thought to myself, oh God, he's partly cooked.
Well, parts of him were, as you might expect if you
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Oh.
Well, her version, the original version is half again as long.
Right.
But whew, it is amazing.
Yeah.
It's and where'd from, you get where did I get
Where'd
it?
Where'd you get the book? Yeah.
I think Susan Gordon might have given me the book. I don't know where I got it. I've had it a long time, and I only just started reading it recently. It's a book of fairy tales called The Djinn in the Nightingale's Eye. And
Djinn?
Yeah, D-J-I-N-N, spelled the Middle Eastern way, I guess.
Yeah.
The genie in the Nightingale's Eye. And there's five fairy tales. That's the subheading is Five Fairy Stories by A.S. Byatt. And I looked up her autobiography. She was a very interesting person.
How do you spell her last name?
B-Y-A-T-T. B as in boy.
Oh, I'll be darned.
Y-A-T-T.
I guess B-Y-A-T, but two now T's. I just had to put another T on it.
Yes. So she was a scholar and obviously a storyteller. She wrote all kinds of different things, collections of scholarly essays, poetry. She's famous for a novel called Possession, which I have not looked up.
Possession?
Mm-hmm. But she has several novels, and she died in something like 1963, maybe?
That sounds scary. possession.
But if any of her novels are anything like that story, I'm not sure I'm capable of reading them.
Oh, you don't like reading horror stories, huh?
No, well, if they're killing short, stories. I can handle them if they're short. I can't maintain. Mm-hmm. Well, you've been listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, listeners, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stosh Ziolkowski.
And I think Stosh has a story for us.
Okay. And say our theme again to me so I can...
Grateful for the now.
Right. Okay.
And we are slightly halfway through our show.
Right. Okay.
Slightly more than halfway.
Right. Okay. Well, I thought about this long and hard, and because after you sent that title, you said grateful for the now, and then you said after, I can't think, after a tragedy.
Well, that's my interpretation of the title, but your interpretation is fine, whatever it is.
Right. Well, I thought about that, and I thought about tragedy. Where was a tragedy that I was dealing with? So, and I did remember that on November 28th, 1950, my sister's first husband, Raymond Gallant, was killed during the Korean War. And it was a tragedy to our family, a real terrible tragedy. He was only 22 years old. He and my sister had gotten married in 1948. And my sister had given birth to a daughter, in November of 1949. And just shortly after that, Ray went into what was sent to Korea. He had actually been in the Navy during at the end of the Second World War, but he had gone in and lied about his age. But he joined the 29th Division in Baltimore, went to Korea, was killed. And the time after that, I thought about the title, Grateful for the Now. My sister was, my whole life was one of my best friends. She was my biggest supporter. She was always proud of everything I did. She showered me with so much love. She was truly like a second mother. She took care of me as an infant. In fact, she was 12 years older than I am, and in the neighborhood, there were some people who talked about her when she would carry me around the neighborhood or push me in a little buggy and things, because they actually thought that was her baby. And so there were some stories told around the neighborhood that this young girl had a baby, but that wasn't true. It was just that my mother was not a well woman, and Marcy was a good girl who took care of me. So immediately after my sister was informed about her husband, in fact, while he was away, she had talked about moving in with us. And so she did. Soon after, we had the news that he was deceased. And so she moved in. And part of me being grateful about that time was that I got my sister back home in the house with me, because she always looked after me and it was good to have her in the house. Of course, she got a job, she went to work, and we helped to raise my brother Tony and I. Tony is 3 years older than I am, so he was just 9 years younger than Marcy. We helped to raise Lydia. Lydia came to us as a child that was just a little over a year old. And we babysat for Lydia, took her for walks. I often took her with me when I went out to see the guys in the neighborhood. And, you know, sometimes she was kind of like a good luck charm or something when we were playing street ball and things, and I would have her sitting on the sidewalk and watching what we were doing. It wound up that when Lydia was old enough to go to school, she went to kindergarten, and I took her to school. And in fact, one of my treasured pictures is a picture of Lydia in her graduation gown from kindergarten and me in my graduation gown from eighth grade. And it's kind of funny because I actually remember, when I think about it, I remembered that we both were in Gaps and gowns and we both graduated on, but I had forgotten about it for a long time. And when I did think about it, I thought, I didn't even remember that really happening that much with kindergarten children. Of course, I didn't have a good memory of my kindergarten graduation, if there was one. And but Lydia's graduation was a big deal to our family. And, you know, everyone in our family missed her father. It's a shame that she never got to really know her father. But there were so many wonderful things that happened because of my sister and Lydia living with us. My sister eventually did get married again, and then she and Lydia moved with her second husband and left the house, and so you know, we didn't have Lydia with us all the time, but we made such a strong bond that today, 70 some years later, Lydia is still very close to her two uncles, Uncle Tony, my older brother, who's 85, and Uncle Stosh, who I and I maybe too. And we still see her frequently. We talk to her right back and forth or through email and Facebook. And we have done lots of things together over the years. Lots of family reunions, lots of family get-togethers, lots of meals, lots of visits back and forth. And a number of times, Lydia joined me on my trips down to the Eastern Shore when my brother lived in Pocomoke City, near Ocean City. And Lydia would sometimes go with me when I would visit the area and then drive down from the Baltimore area to see my brother Tony. So it was a tragedy when Lydia's father died in the war, but because of that, I got to help with her childhood, her early childhood, and to this day, she is one of my favorite people on the planet. A dear, dear person who always has nice things to say and who has shown me a great deal of love in my life. And so that was a very special thing, a very special time for me. And my brother and I have often talked about it. Lydia, he lives in an assisted living home, and Lydia sometimes goes over and visits him. Sometimes she meets us for lunch when we take him out to lunch, and it is always a good time. And anyway, that I am grateful for that time.
That's a wonderful story. Thank you, Sash.
Oh, you're
welcome.
I hope
someday I get to meet Lydia.
And oh, she is. Yeah. I'm not sure about Tony, possibly Lydia. Tony doesn't travel that much, except we take him to the hospital back and forth. Right. He just did, speaking of graduations, he just did finish his 15th and final treatment, radiation treatment. He has lung cancer. And so for 15 treatments at the VA hospital in Baltimore, and he had quite an adventure with that. It's over now, but he's a good trooper. Because of the round trip to Baltimore to the VA hospital, when we go take Tony, is the round trip to his place is almost 170 miles. When we pick him up and take him to the hospital, our round trip is almost 200 miles. And actually, it's a little over 200 miles by the time you figure in going to lunch and everything, a little side trip. But so when he had to go to the VA hospital, which is about 10 or 12 miles from his, where he lives, maybe 13. We decided that instead of making a 200 mile round trip to take him to each one of those appointments, we would use the Uber driving services because his treatments in the hospital only took about 35 minutes. So to drive 100 miles and just sit there for 35 minutes and then take him back home, it seemed like that would be a lot of expense and a lot of time, and we would have almost no time at all with him. So we decided that an Uber driver could take him to the hospital and another one could pick him up. And so for 14 days, 14 treatments, he had a great time with the Uber drivers. And there were adventures a couple of times. The first couple of times, they had trouble finding his place and getting into the hospital because of the entrance to the hospital where he had to be dropped off with his walker and then get a wheelchair and all was a bit. But he soldiered on through it. I should say sailored. He's a vet. He's from the Navy. He sailored on through it. And he met a lot of people and just raved about the politeness and the kindness and the good manners and fellowship that he met through each of these drivers. He had 28 different drivers.
Wow. He had
28 Uber rides, you know. And he said, it was interesting because some barely said a word. They were just very, you know, professional when they're driving and whatever, but they helped him with his walker in and out of the cab and everything. And, but some of them talked. He said he learned a lot about some things. And some of them were not English speaking, were not normally English speakers, but managed to get across their stories to him. And so he had a great time. And on last Thursday, his last treatment, he graduated. They gave him a certificate, just like a diploma, with his name written beautifully, very nice, calligraphy. And it was a very formal thing and in a nice folder. And so he could put that on his wall in his room at the assisted living facility. And the VA hospital has a tradition when any veteran finishes any of their treatment for things like cancer, the radiation treatments or any like surgery and stuff, and they're being released, they get to ring the bell in that part of the hospital. Which is a really neat thing. And my brother, who did not finish high school, and of course he got a GED certificate later, but he never went to college, was just as proud of that certificate, finishing the radiation treatments, as if it was a college diploma, and is now displayed on his wall in his room. So even though having someone get cancer is tragic and can be deadly, the now part, I'm grateful for the now part. My brother has completed that, and the doctor has high hopes that they have fixed him in that area. So we had a great celebration. We took him out to lunch, and we even had lunch, and we each had a special different piece of pie to celebrate his triumph.
Wow.
And it was, you know, it was really nice to do that.
When did he have that last treatment?
Last Thursday.
Wow.
On the 16th. And it was another celebration for us because it was 2 years, exactly 2 years to the day that we moved here to Martinsburg.
Wow.
So
I had no idea it's been that long.
Yes. How about that? 2 years, mm-hmm. 730 days. It's incredible. And now it's been a little more than 730 days. That, you know, and we like it here very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A nice, cozy place. And where I'm sitting is I'm very cozy right next to our fireplace and on the radio. I am really looking forward to next Monday.
Me too.
And, and I know my brother is very happy about this week because he doesn't have a single appointment with a doctor or a test or anything else, which is unusual because for a long time, there were some weeks when we were with him for two or three different appointments because he does have some other health issues. But he's sailing on through. and he's happy to have a week away from doctors and appointments and stuff, and which is good.
Well, I have a question just to satisfy my own curiosity. So when you prepared for the show today, was it that story about Tony that you had planned to tell, or was it or a different story?
Well, I thought about that story because it was so fresh and so mm-hmm. and new, and I found it, you know, I found it. Lots of people get sick and lots of people have problems. Tony has all kinds of problems because of his advanced age and he's lived a hard life. But I kind of put that on the side because I reflected on when you had sent me the suggestion for the theme and you'd mentioned following a tragedy in your description. And I thought, you know, I don't think I've had many tragedies in my life. I've had some, of course, with family deaths, but that is a normal part of life. If you live long enough, you're going to suffer for, you know, losing people. But my brother-in-law Ray's death was such a tragedy for our family because he was so beloved. You know, he and my sister got married when he was 21 and she was, or he was 20 and she was 18. And they were so much in love and he was so important in our family. My father treated him just like another son. In fact, when he died, my father was very crushed by that death because he had lost a younger brother in the Second World War. And anyway, Ray was very popular. He lived in the Baltimore area just for a few years before. And in our church, he was very popular. He did lots of things around the church, helping out with different stuff. He worked on the same kind of job that my father had, and they became very close. anyway, his death was a terrible tragedy to us, but because my sister and my daughter, my niece, got to live with us again for a number of years, it became a very happy time for our family to see this little girl being raised. And she was so adorable. And she became, her mother was the apple of my father's eye. However, Lydia became the apple of his eye. His granddaughter became somebody extremely special to him, you know. And so that was a real gift to our family that they lived with us again for a number of years.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stories all.
Yeah. Good. So we've been on for a while. I think we're at 55 minutes or 56.
I think
minutes.
We are. You're right. All right. Do you have any closing words for us?
Well, probably nothing of importance.
You said a lot of importance.
I do have an appointment tomorrow for an EMG, electromyography.
Wow.
I'm going to get all the muscles in my legs are going to be examined and tested with electricity, with needles in my legs and stuff. They're going to see if my muscles are working properly to stimulate blood flow, because I'm having a lot of trouble with my legs. I'm going through physical therapy and that, so I'm looking forward to this EMG. It took me a while to figure out what it meant.
Well, you can give us a report next week then.
Yes.
This is Fanny Crawford and
Stosh Ziolkowski,
your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We are independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. And it's time to close the show. The Storytelling Hour offers our listeners a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for John Case and...
Oh, it's Country Music Day on Enlightened Radio. So if you're in the rural, you know, Trumpy areas of the country, this is a program for you. Okay. So anyway.
Hey, and